Welcome to Rails with Jason. If you enjoyed today's episode and want more Rails tips and advice, head over to codewithjason.com, where I keep all my Rails articles and videos. Now on to the episode. Welcome. Today I have two guests on the show, Kelly Sutton and Kent Beck, both from Gusto. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Oh, you said gentlemen, so I assumed you weren't talking to us.
Yeah, I was going to say it's interesting having you two as guests on the show because one of you is a famous programmer and the other one is some guy named Kent Beck.
Nicely done.
Yeah, I just had to get that joke out of the way. A common theme of this show is unfunny jokes by me. Anyway, I want to give you guys a little bit of a chance to introduce yourselves for the listeners who haven't heard about you. Kelly, would you like to go first?
Sure. My name is Kelly Sutton. I'm a software engineer here at Gusto. I've been at Gusto for a few years now. Generally, when it comes to programming, I'm a big fan of delivering value to the customer. So over the course of my career, I've been very focused on using Ruby on Rails and other technologies that allow me as a programmer to just put the best product I can in front of my customer.
Awesome. Kent, how about you?
I've been at Gusto almost a year now. This is my first professional encounter with Ruby and with Rails. Walked into a code base that's grown organically over the past 6 or 7 years and supports a fantastic business. And we would like it to continue supporting even more fantastic business.
And Ken, I have a question for you that's maybe kind of relevant to that. So you've said you've been at Gusto for about a year. A common challenge when starting a new job, of course, is getting acclimated and getting familiar with the code base that you're going to be working with. So can you tell us a little bit about how you tend to approach that, getting familiar with a new code base?
Well, my leverage doesn't come so much from knowing a code base well and being able to perform magic tricks with it, but being able to build relationships with programmers that help them to grow. So I kind of dove in. I did some quantitative analysis of the code base, you know, where is complexity, where is change happen? Kind of introduced the team to my vocabulary and then did lots of listening sessions with individual programmers, tidying up a little bit, which frankly, many of them didn't seem to value as highly as I do, but there you go. That's going to be that way sometime.
Okay. And that kind of makes sense. Gusto probably hired you more for your ability to improve the skills of their existing developers rather than say, hey, Kent, here's the code base, get coding.
Yep.
Makes sense.
That's my interpretation of it. I hope my boss thinks the same.
And actually, let me ask, just for context, can you guys both tell me a little bit about your role at Gusto? Kent, I know you kind of described that a little bit, but maybe you could go into a little more detail on what your job is there.
Yeah, so I've gone through a variety of different provisional job titles, and the one I've landed on is programmer at large. So I don't have responsibility for particular features or areas of the code base. If I do my job right, 5 years from now, Gusto engineering will be much larger than it is today. you know, 3, 4, 5x, and we'll still be able to operate the software better than we can operate it today. We'll be able to modify it better than we can modify it today. And we'll be able to introduce even more developers to the team and to the code base. And so it's a broad responsibility. I don't have any direct reports. I also have a role of taking the observations that I make with individual programmers and talking to executives about, you know, US, we're talking about this strategic issue. And yesterday I was refactoring with this person and saw this thing which bears on that issue. So it's kind of a dual role.
Okay. And Kelly, how about you? What's your role at Gusto?
I'm closer to what you would probably consider just a more traditional software engineering individual contributor. I've been here, I've been at Gusto long enough that a lot of the problems, you know, I can't blame things on my predecessors, so I created a lot of the problems. but generally, I've spent my time at Gusto mostly, to put some broad strokes on it, dealing with a lot of the technical debt or scaling challenges that we might have come across, and then also helping the business decide, like, okay, what are the problems going to be, you know, 12 to 24 months from now, and what can we start doing today to kind of mitigate what those issues might be. So,
okay. Yeah. And just curious, how long have you been there?
A little over 3 years. Okay. The company was founded in 2012.
Got it.
So almost half of its lifetime, which is a weird thought. Yeah.
And they do payroll stuff?
We're a small business people platform. Kelly, I should have let you go. We've both been brainwashed the same place. Which means that if you're a small business, the kinds of the mechanics of dealing with people, payroll, benefits, onboarding, we're there to take the complexity of that out of it so that you can get back to throwing pots or making pizzas or cutting hair,
okay,
whatever it is that you care about. And it turns out there's lots and lots of small businesses. And our goal is to make those businesses more successful and their employees more successful.
Got it. And I'm guessing you store your monetary values as floats?
I was just thinking that before this started. I was like, what's the one thing that you can say somebody's definitely doesn't know what they're doing? Oh, if you store monetary values in floats. Literally.
Oh, man.
Let's say we have plenty of challenges.
Yeah. Hopefully challenges of a higher level of sophistication than that particular one. And by the way, in case anybody's listening and they don't know why you shouldn't store your monetary values as floats, I won't belabor the point here, but like go Google it. And like there's examples of like you divide one number by another number and it's like 0.0000003 or something like that. Like it's not exactly correct. Yep. Anyway, what I brought you guys on the show to talk about is stuff related to the recent videos that you've been putting out, which started, I understand, as a blog post that you wrote, Kent, called Test Desiderata. And
you've been practicing that word, I can tell. Beautifully done.
I had to like watch a number of your videos to like find a video where you actually said the word so I knew how to say it. Turns out you said it in the very first one. But first, can you give a little context around that? It's from a poem, is that right? The word?
Yes. Well, I'm sure the word's older than that. So it's a desiderata is a list of desirable properties. Okay. And yes, there is a beautiful poem which my cynical father introduced me to the satirical version of, which is called the Deteriorata, about all the how horrible the world is. That was more my dad's speed. But We have a variety of styles of testing at Gusto, and I've encountered them outside of Gusto as well, where people will give up some property of good property of tests for reasons that I'm not convinced are compelling. But they say, well, I'm going to have non-deterministic tests. Tests that sometimes pass and sometimes fail. And I don't have any choice about that. Not realizing, A, the cost that comes with having non-deterministic tests, and B, without understanding the costs of making those tests deterministic. So I thought, I'm just going to make a list of all the good properties I would like my tests to have, acknowledging that sometimes there'll be a trade-off and I'll get more of one and less of another, but I want to make those trade-offs on purpose.
Okay. And are you saying you've encountered people who know the difference between deterministic tests and non-deterministic tests and choose to have non-deterministic tests?
Sure.
Oh, wow. Okay. I find that surprising. But apparently it's the case. All right.
So some context there might help a little bit, which is like sometimes like Gusto's code base, for example, right? It is like, I think given the choice and given the, knowing the property of determinism and tests, you'd almost always choose determinism. But if getting too deterministic is too difficult or too expensive and it's going to take you a long time, you might choose not to, right?
I see. It's not like they're making a conscious choice, like non-deterministic is better than deterministic. It's more like, for lack of a kinder term, laziness or something like that, where it's like, yeah, we want it to be deterministic, but it's just so hard to get it there that we're just going to settle for the non-deterministic
one. Yeah, I'm never going to apply the word lazy to it. A kind of thing is using a clock time or a calendar, and it's just easy. Hey, I need the current time. Let me fetch the current time. And then later on in a computation, you say, well, I need the time here. I'll just use the current time. And if you happen to be running over a midnight, the dates of those two are not going to match. And then you'll have a test fail. But it only fails if you're running tests right over midnight or on a leap year, on a leap day, or across a month boundary or something like that. The idea that you should grab the time when some transaction starts and then pass that around, it's not obviously an important thing to do, and then you have one more parameter that you have to pass around. And it's not until it bites you at 12:02 a.m. sometime that you realize, I need to have one date associated with this, and I need to lock that down at the beginning or at the end of this transaction and not just rely on an answer that just happens to be correct most of the time. I don't see that as laziness. That's just like it's a pitfall. You got to stumble into it before you realize, oh, no, this matters and it's worth it.
Yeah, I'm glad you found a better way to characterize it, because I knew laziness was not getting it spot on. And I know exactly what you're talking about, because I had an instance where I was working on an app for some months in the year 2018, and all the tests passed just fine in 2018. Then January 1st, 2019, things mysteriously stopped working. And it turns out in some places I had hard-coded the year 2018, not realizing that someday it would matter.
Yeah.
If you can fix that problem in a Rails code base, you'd be a great engineer at Gusto.
Oh, yeah?
To some degree, that is the job, making sure the software runs well year to year and quarter to quarter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so as long as we're talking about determinism, did we actually did we actually say what determinism means specifically? Like, I know that you guys know and I know, but did we actually say like precisely what that is for the listener's benefit?
A deterministic test gives you the same answer as long as the code hasn't changed every single time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, of course, is one desirable property of tests. Sorry, Kelly, did you have something?
I was just going to say, and then the ways that tests become not deterministic are, you know, things like system clock, things usually outside of your control, like the system clock, database IDs, other services, stuff like that.
Random numbers,
yep.
Yeah, and I can tell you a couple of common things in my experience. So in my terminology, we will have tests that sometimes pass and sometimes fail. Usually those are capybara tests. And usually the we call those flaky tests or flapping tests. Yep. And I know different people have different terms for those kinds of tests. But usually it's some kind of race condition. Like you load a page and you submit a form, and then after the form submits, you're on some other page and you click a link and go to yet another page. Well, maybe sometimes that the form submits and the next page gets served more slowly than expected, and so you can't click that link, and so the test fails. Not always, but just sometimes. So race conditions are the culprit a lot of times in my experience too.
Yes. That's another one of those external resources that you can't control.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
How quickly something responds, or if you make a network request and the network's down, your test fails, but the code is just fine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And by the way, the way that I usually fix those capybara race conditions is that instead of, for example, letting the form submit and then going straight to clicking the link, I'll let the form submit and then I'll say, expect the page to have certain content that lets me know that I'm on that page, and then I'll click the link. That makes capybara not get ahead of itself. Okay. So we kind of touched on determinism, which is one of the traits.
One of the 12.
One of the 12. Is there anything else that's particularly important from the list that we want to make sure we touch on, or should I just arbitrarily pick something for us to talk about?
Well, why don't you pick something that you find interesting?
Okay. I'll pick one that I don't understand right offhand, which is writable. What do you mean when you say that tests should be writable?
For tests to be writable, you want, if you ever find yourself saying, you know what, this is just going to be a pain in the butt to write, I'm not going to write this test, even though you know, like you've got that nagging guilt saying that I should really write a test for this. That is what it means for tests to be writable. You want to be able to write tests for the important behavior in your application.
So if you have to set up a database or mock the results of a complicated HTTP response, it's going to take you half an hour to figure out how to fill out all the fields correctly. That's not a writable test. One of the consistent themes about all these properties is oftentimes they're not testing problems, they're software design problems. So I would say in the case of a complicated network response, the problem is you're doing two things at once. You're taking that response and you're breaking it up into pieces, and then you're sending those pieces in to be computed. And if you conflate the two, if you have code that does a little bit of both at the same time, it's going to be really hard to write tests for it. If you instead split that into two dimensions, one of which is parsing the network response and extracting values, and the other of which is, given those values, computing with it, then writing the tests for given these values, compute with it is straightforward. And the other side of it is relatively straightforward, given this string coming back over the network. I should extract these values.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Well, here's what I think you're trying to say, and tell me if I'm understanding this right or not. It seems like maybe if you discover that you're about to build a feature and the test is just really daunting to write and seems like really complicated, then maybe that's a hint that the feature you're trying to write is maybe you're not going about it in a great way, and you could go about it in a different way that's more easily testable and also happens to be a better way to write the feature too. Am I kind of getting that right?
Yes, the tests can exert pressure on you as a designer to improve the design. But this is, so a second theme of the desiderata is that we're dealing with trade-offs oftentimes. And sometimes you can make tests more writable, in this case by separating these two dimensions, but that might make it more difficult to have confidence that the resulting code works, because you say, well, how do I know that these two things are hooked together? So I make the tests more writable, but now I have to find some other source of confidence, as opposed to, hey, I'm just going to always test at the level of network transactions, and then I'm sure that everything runs end to end.
Got it. Yeah, and that seems like maybe just kind of a judgment call as far as, I don't know, how do you decide what granularity you're going to write your tests at?
So we've got the last two episodes coming out of like the 12 properties, desirable properties of tests here, and the last two are predictive and inspiring. And so for me, when I'm writing tests, like, I want to be able to sit here and record a podcast with you, Jason, and know that I have a green test suite and a deploy going out to production and nothing bad is going to happen, right? So when it comes to like how many tests do I write and what level do I write them at, it's really whatever it takes to inspire confidence. That I don't have to babysit my code, or I don't have to get into, you know, that really bummer of a situation where the tests are green but production is down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes me think about, like, you know, sometimes people talk about test coverage and what percentage is a good percentage to shoot for, and I don't think about it that way myself. I think about it more like I ask the question of what is the code base like to work with. Like, are deployments scary because they're risky because there's not that good of test coverage? And are there bugs popping up a lot that seem like bugs that are a symptom of not having enough test coverage? And I use that as kind of my compass to make me think, oh, okay, we're doing okay on test coverage, or we need some more test coverage, or that kind of thing. How do you guys think about that whole topic?
So I add regressions to that list. If you say, hey, I know I fixed this bug 3 months ago and it's back, then you don't have enough tests.
Mm-hmm.
Having some strict number on some metric really doesn't matter. Can you sleep at night?
Yeah.
Can you go on vacation? Can you add new behavior to the system without unintentionally changing existing behavior? Those are qualitative. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, like, do you have the trust of your business counterparts, right? Like, if it makes you look pretty bad as a software engineer if you say, we have 95% test coverage, and your business counterparts is like, yeah, but there's still a ton of bugs and the site's down right now, so I don't care about that.
Yeah, very good point. And I want to go back to something else we touched on a minute ago, which is, like, we talked about tests being writable, and that made me think about, you know, sometimes tests are daunting to write because there's this like mountain of tedium in between where you are now and where the finished test would be. And that can be like the result of poor design or whatever. But sometimes it's like you just can't muster the discipline to like get yourself to do it. Even if the test isn't a particularly hard one to write, it's like, I got to write this test. I don't want to. Do you guys have any advice for getting over that hump?
Well, it sounds like I don't know if you beat yourself up, Jason, but I am a champion beat myself upper. That sounds pretty self-shamey. You know, if only I had discipline, if I was a better programmer, then I would definitely write tests in this case. And I don't find that kind of self-criticism to be productive, but that doesn't mean I don't do it all the time. I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. Sometimes I code without writing tests, and if there is a low chance of failure, a low consequence of failure, sometimes I just don't know what the right answer is, and the only way I can find the right answer is by writing some code and seeing what answers come out of it. Those are all good reasons to code without tests. If my teammates are counting on me and my customers are counting on me and my investors are counting on me and I'm likely to make mistakes and I'm not writing tests, then I need to take a step back and understand my own motivations better. Like, what's that? There's definitely something strange going on there, and more programming or forcing myself to write tests, even though I don't want to, isn't really going to address the problem.
Yeah. Part of why I asked that was because it's kind of an answer. It's kind of a question that I already have my own answer to, and I was curious to see how much your answer might overlap with mine. I kind of came to a real, because somebody asked me that question once. They're like, how do you make testing a habit? And like, how do you write tests when you like don't feel like it? And I had to dig deep within myself for the answer. And I discovered that the way that I've made myself do that is, at some point along my programming journey, I convinced myself that it's easier, faster, and more enjoyable to write code with tests than without tests. And ever since I kind of deeply ingrained that in my mind, it hasn't been all that hard to get myself to write tests. So I don't know. That's one way of thinking about it too.
Yeah. And I think, to me, testing and like practicing TDD was actually one of the things that leveled me up the fastest as a young software engineer. But it was also the most difficult to get right. And I think kind of echoing like Kent's sentiment, like there are some times where I will write code and I won't write a test. But maybe what my brain is doing there is like, well, I've written the test for code that looks very similar to this, you know, 10 different times. I know what the tests are going to tell me from a design perspective. And I'm building in this a few properties into my code of like, you know, it's like complete atomic failure, and it's not like a business risk. So writing a test doesn't, if it fails in production, it's going to fail very clearly, and it's not going to harm the business. I won't write a test for that.
So there was one of the lessons. I was at Facebook for 7 years, 2011 to 2018. And when I got there, I was surprised how few automated tests there were. And thought, well, you know, now I'm here, I'll fix this. And I have the long version of that story. But this short one is, what I realized is that many of the mistakes that occurred at scale could not be reproduced outside of the production environment. So spending weeks trying to simulate some failure that you didn't even know was possible before you tried out some feature was just futile. And instead, it was more important to be able to make deployment decisions reversible, either with quick deployments or with feature flags. And then you'd try stuff out. If you can't reproduce the condition, the failure conditions, then beating yourself up because you can't reproduce the failure condition, that doesn't help you. It takes just means it takes longer to learn the lessons. So that was a case where there was a trade-off that I wasn't aware of walking in. There were lots of forms of feedback available to you as a programmer. It was just that when peak load happened at 3 p.m. Eastern and or Pacific and things started to go haywire, there was no way that you could have known that that would happen.
Yeah, if you think you know, setting up a browser in a capybara test is expensive, like reproducing that is like, okay, great, we need a data center, and we need billions of people's worth of simulated traffic at 3 p.m. and then we can run our test.
Yeah, wow, that's a whole different ball game.
That sounds like an expensive test for me.
No, we do have complicated scenarios at Gusto, but they're complicated because the domain of taxes and benefits are complicated, not because we have really hard distributed systems problems. I like to say all of our customer data would fit on a thumb drive, but what makes it interesting and challenging and engaging as an engineer is we have this unbelievably complicated domain where the state of Oregon's workman's comp rules change, and here's how you need to apply them retroactively, blah, 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 blah.
Kent, what if that person is living in Vancouver, Washington, but they're working in Portland?
Oh, no, then everything's different.
Oh, right. Yes.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can only imagine. I've been working with some similarly complex stuff lately. I've been working with medical billing, which you can imagine has all kinds of similar intricacies. Oh,
come on. Come on now, Jason. How complicated can that be? You've got a billing code that translates to a dollar amount, and then it's all done and dusted. Come on.
I could build that in a weekend. Come on.
I'll just give you one of my favorite little aspects of it, which is I learned that the insurance companies will deliberately underpay randomly and just by a very small amount on a lot of their reimbursements. It's just like an office space, you know, that scam where they would like take one penny from a bunch of different people or whatever. It's the exact same thing, except they're really doing it.
Fuzz testing with real money. I like it.
Yeah, it's totally crazy. Okay, so the one we just touched on was tests should be writable. It seems natural now to talk about tests should be readable. What do we mean by that?
Every test should tell a story. Imagine that you're coming to this code later and you ask the critically important question, what in the world was the original programmer thinking? Readable tests give you a journal. Well, I was thinking about this computation, and here's what the answer should be. And I was thinking about that computation, and here's what that answer should be. And I was thinking about this other one. You say, well, didn't you think about case number four? And the answer is no, because if you had thought about case number four, there'd be a test for it. So arranging tests, the names that you choose, the data values that you choose, they can be chosen to be, sometimes people will say, well, but that's not realistic. Exchange rate that's 2-to-1, that's not very realistic. Well, no, it's not realistic, but it makes it easy to read the tests and understand what the relationships of the inputs are to the outputs. So pick names, pick values that satisfy the need to exercise the code, yes, but pick names and values that make it easy to read and understand the intention.
Yeah, there was something interesting I read. I was going through that giant tome by it was X Unit Patterns by Gerard. How do you say his last name?
Mazaros.
Okay. I never knew how to say it. But anyway, I was going through that, and there was a section about noisy setup data. I don't remember that. It was like a test smell. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, and I mean, I'll see this a lot
obscure test. That was the name of the test smell, obscure test.
Yeah, and I think the folks over at Test Double have a great Git repo with a bunch of other test smells as well. I forget the exact name for this, but it's an unreadable test is one where you have to ask what of this test setup code actually matters, right?
Here's an exercise that I do. Print out a test on paper, tape it all together if it needs multiple pages, already you're suspicious. And then take a yellow highlighter and highlight if you're explaining the test to somebody else, use the highlighter to highlight the portions of the test that actually matter in the explanation. And if you have, I've seen cases like this where 1/20th of the characters are highlighted, and that's not a readable test. It's also probably pretty hard to write, except you probably copied and pasted it from the previous test and changed some stuff, which doesn't make for a writable test really, but it's definitely not readable.
Yeah, so like an unreadable test for, I don't know, just drawing from like our domain would be something that validates a social security number, right? The thing that identifies U.S. citizens for tax purposes, basically. If you have to set up an employee to do that, but an employee isn't valid unless they're also attached to a company, and a company isn't valid unless there's an admin on the account. And, you know, if you're creating 100 records in a database just to say, like, is this a 9-digit string? that is not a very readable test, because if you do Kent's exercise, like, you're going to be highlighting one or two lines in all of that printout there.
And there's a different way to design the underlying code that doesn't require all of that stuff to be set up in order to check that you've got 9 numerical digits.
Yeah. And I think the interesting one about readable for me is there's a fork in the road that you can take, which is you can say, like, well, I'm going to dry up the code that it takes to set up an employee. I'm going to make that simple. But you've kind of just swept the problem under the rug, which is you're still creating 100 records in a database just to do something very simple. But there's another fork that you can take, which is to say, I'm going to change the design of my code because my tests are giving me some feedback here. Readability is one of those properties that I really try to listen to when my tests kind of go off the cliff there. I ask, like, okay, what does this tell me about the code that I'm trying to write?
Yeah, and this is reminding me of something. I'm kind of thinking of like a before and after, like the way maybe the old me would have written this and the way the new me would have written this. I could imagine doing this in such a way where like the employee class inherits from Active Record. In order to bring one of those into existence, you have that chain of dependencies like you described, all for the purpose of just validating that employee's social security number. Today, what I might do is I might have a social security number poro, plain old Ruby object, and have a dot valid question mark method on that social security number class. And then my test could just instantiate a social security number object and you know, put it through various scenarios of valid and invalid social security numbers and never have to involve the employee class or any database records at all, which I think it has certain pros and cons, but I think probably I'd consider it a net win.
Yeah, so now you're hinting at the property that I called composable, where you say once you have an isolated bit of code that validates social security numbers, then in the rest of the system, you can assume that social security numbers are valid. You don't have to go making extra checks and writing extra tests for that, as long as that dimension of social security number validation is taken care of in one place and only one place, then everybody else can make the assumption that socials are valid, and that lets you simplify your code and your tests. But there's an art to designing the code and then designing the tests so that invariant remains valid.
And there's a, I might even push that a little bit further, and this is something that I've done at Gusto a few times, which is to say, if you're newing up that social security number class, Jason, that you've written, I shouldn't have to ask, is this valid or not? Like, it should actually just, it should not be able to exist if it is invalid. And when you start thinking that way, or at least when I've started thinking that way, that's when things really opened up for me. In just that, I just have to write fewer tests, because if I have a social security number, it is by definition valid. And then use that to feed into, how my tests are composed and so on and so forth.
Right. And compare that to, okay, we're going to test everything outside in from the browser. We have to have this kind of invalid social and that kind of invalid social and another kind of invalid social. And then we have to worry about, yeah, the address is valid, but the social's invalid, and then the address is invalid, and the social's valid, and the combinatorics of that is just going to kill you.
Yeah. And you do have to worry about this stuff, like, at some layer, but you want most of your system to just assume that everything's okay, so that you're not being overly defensive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Okay. So is that the main idea of composability? I have to admit, I don't completely understand what we mean by composability yet. Can you guys help me out some more?
I think you have the concept, but maybe just not the word for it, which is there's a bunch of different ways that a social security number can be invalid. You have this social security object that either has a is valid question mark, or that throws an exception from the constructor if it's passed an invalid string as input. And now you don't, this is where I'd like physical gestures. You've separated out, I'm making a right angle with my hands now. You've separated out validation of social security numbers from all the other concerns in the system. You've dealt with it in one place, and now you don't have to worry about that anywhere else. And that's both a design style or goal, and also a testing style, where sometimes it feels a little weird because you have to make a step of inference. You have to say, if all of these things, if address validations work and social security validations work, then from those two facts, I can infer that the employee validation is valid. And maybe you want to have one test that makes sure that the two things tie together the way that you expect them to. But you don't have to look at the cross product of all the ways socials can be bad and all the ways that addresses can be bad if they're actually dealt with separately in the code, and those separate dimensions of code can't interact with each other. Then you can compose the results of the tests along this dimension with the results of tests along that dimension to gain confidence about the whole cross product.
Okay. And we probably have time for one or maybe two more before it's time for us to go. But the one that caught my eye next was behavioral. What do you mean when you say that tests should be behavioral?
Go ahead, Kelly.
So a test should test the behavior of the system under test and not its structure. So what does it do, not how does it do it? So if you have something that, like in our videos, we use the example of calculating minimum wage, right? That should just be inputs and outputs. It shouldn't care, like, well, I'm using multiplication or I'm using some like crude addition, right? Whatever it is, it doesn't. It's the separation of the implementation from the public behavior. Right?
Yeah.
So a refinement that Kelly and I were talking about yesterday is, if you change how the code behaves, the results of the tests should change. Sometimes I see tests where assertions are, this value is not null. And I think, well, that's not actually testing the behavior, because there's lots of non-null values that could come back. And if this test passes on all of them, that's not really, like, that can't be right. I don't know what somebody was thinking when they wrote that assertion, or maybe they wrote it another way and then modified it to there, or somebody else modified it to just be non-null. But that's not testing the behavior of the system. Tests should be sensitive to changes in the behavior of the system. But whether I have some computation inside a module or outside of a module, or if I convert inputs to floats before, that's probably not a good example. If internal details of how some computation happens, the test results shouldn't change. And there are tests that fail that property too, but that's not the one you ask about. But if I change the answers, the test results should change.
That makes sense. So,
a good like litmus test here. So like behavior is a bit like a behavior sensitive, but structure insensitive. Those are kind of two neighbors there. Like a test is not behavioral if you refactor it and the tests fail, even though you know, as a software engineer, the behavior has not changed. It's still doing the right multiplication or the right validation. You can even deploy it to production, and the code is still doing what you want it to, but the tests are red. That tells me, like, we've failed on the behavioral axis of it.
All right, so I want to ask you a question that I know what I think of this, but just for my own smug satisfaction, I want to hear you guys agree with me. Which I think you probably will. And I also
that's a challenge I'm willing to take, Jason.
And I want other people to hear this too, because this is something that just really, really bothers me. Is there value, or how much value is there in having a test that says, for example, verify that this active record model has this certain association?
So this is like a has many, or a belongs to, or a has
one.
I mean, it has value if you like typing twice as much. Like if you just like the sound of your keyboard, then yeah, it's got value. Like the tests and the code should never map one-to-one, right? They should complement each other. And I'm assuming that relationship is going to get exercised by something else down the line. And that one is the type of thing that Rails is going to handle it for you. And if you don't trust how Rails handles that relationship, there's a different problem there.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, it's not even about trusting Rails. It's the way I would put it is, I wouldn't want to test for the presence of that association, not for the mere presence of the association. I would want to test the behavior that the presence of that association enables. And that way, if you delete the association, your behavior that's enabled by the association will stop working, and your test that tests that will break. But I think testing that one little mechanical piece by itself doesn't really add much value.
Yeah, so that test fails this structure insensitive. So let's say you have a one-to-one relationship, you have some tests for it, and then you change it to a one-to-many relationship. But all of the scenarios that you've created, where by many we mean one, because we only have one data element, And they should all give the same answer. The test, no test should fail because we've replaced that that relationship.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Okay, we are about at time, so I'll ask you the standard questions now of where can people find you online and stuff like that. And we'll put all the test desiderata stuff in the show notes, if I pronounce that word right. But yeah, Kelly, Kent, where can people find you online?
I'm at kentbeck.com, which doesn't have much stuff on it. I'm on Twitter at Kent Beck. And then I have a YouTube channel at Kelly's, and my videos are being published on that. I think just Kent Beck on YouTube.
And I'm equally easy, KellySutton.com, Kelly Sutton on Twitter.
All right. And that's KellySutton. I think Kent Beck is self-spelling, self-explanatory.
Yeah, you guys in your repeated consonants.
Yeah. Awesome. And yeah, if you just Google test desiderata, D-E-S-I-D-E-R.
And then Google will fill in the rest for you.
Even if you spell it wrong, it'll probably still come up. Awesome. All right, guys. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jason.
Thanks for having us.